Thank you, Dick, for that wonderful introduction, and thank you all for coming. I'm frankly amazed that so many people would show up on a day when it's so outrageously cold. I mean, I come from Boston, which is a city not well known for its warm climate, but nonetheless, when I got out of the airplane yesterday, I noticed I was in a different place. Let me begin by going over a little bit of the history, just to kind of set the context for this work. I began working in cosmology kind of because I was arm-twisted into it by a guy named Henry Tai, who's the person who Dick Bond referred to as T, but it's Tai. that's okay. This was back in about 1979, and Henry had gotten interested in these what were then newfangled theories of physics called grand unified theories. And he came to me one day and asked me whether or not these grand unified theories would produce particles called magnetic monopoles. I had worked previously on magnetic monopoles and other theories, but I knew nothing about grand unified theories. But Henry was able to explain to me what a grand unified theory is very efficiently. And then I went home and thought about it for a little bit and came up with the conclusion that's now known to everybody. It's a fairly obvious conclusion to people who know the basic facts. The answer is yes. Grand unified theories do predict that there should be magnetic monopoles, but they would be outrageously heavy. They would weigh about 10 to the 16 times as much as a proton. So I told Henry you should forget about it. It's just another totally untestable prediction of these grand unified theories. But without missing a beat, Henry came back immediately and said, well, why don't we try to figure out how many of them would have been made in the Big Bang? Now, at first, I have to admit, this idea sounded to me to be completely crazy. I mean, after all, we knew very little about these grand unified theories. I didn't think we knew very much about cosmology and the Big Bang. What hope would there possibly be in putting together these two areas of ignorance to see if anything comes out of it? So it actually took about 6 months of arm twisting by Henry to get me to work on this with him. A key factor in my own psychology was a visit to Cornell, where Henry and I both were, by Steve Weinberg, who had not yet won his Nobel Prize, but it was clear that he was about to. And he was working on exactly this crazy area of applying grand unified theories to cosmology, talking about times like 10 to the minus 35 seconds, which at that time sounded completely absurd. So I decided if Steve Weinberg could work on this, so can I. And Henry and I got to work, and we soon concluded that if grand unified theories were right and conventional cosmology was right, that the universe would be just swimming in these magnetic monopoles. And of course, as you know, we haven't seen any. So we were unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, I'm not sure as things turned out, but we were scooped on this idea by someone named John Preskill, who was then a graduate student of Steve Weinberg's. Now he's a professor at Caltech. So he published this idea that the grand unified theories plus standard cosmology leads to a universe swimming with monopoles. Henry and I then scratched our heads and asked ourselves, is there any way we can salvage this work and get something publishable out of it? So we decided to think a little harder about whether or not there's any way you can modify something to make grand unified theories compatible with cosmology. And working together, we came up with the idea that if the early universe underwent an extremely supercooled phase transition, that could alleviate the glut of magnetic monopoles. And as we were putting the finishing touches on that paper, Henry left for a six-week cheap trip to China. Otherwise, he would have been part of the inflationary paper. But the inflation followed immediately from that, because once one started thinking, and it was really Henry's idea to start thinking about this, to be honest, but once one starts thinking about the consequences of this supercooled phase transition for the expansion rate of the universe, one sees immediately that leads to exponential expansion, and then one could pursue the consequences of that, and that is how inflation was born. So it was a very fascinating time, very, very exciting. Today, I'd like to sort of describe the physics now of this, and the talk is going to be divided into several parts. First, I'd like to just describe, I'm actually going to take a minute to describe the basic physics of this conventional Big Bang theory. Then I will describe the physics of inflationary cosmology. And then towards the end, I'll start talking about the other half of the talk, the string theory landscape, the expansion of the universe, the dark energy, and how all of this might fit together if one is willing to accept this concept known as the A word, the anthropic word. And I won't necessarily tell you you should believe it, but I will try to explain to you that it is a perfectly logical explanation for how all of this might fit together. Okay, so let me begin. So first I want to take out a few minutes just to set the stage here by talking about the conventional Big Bang theory as it was known before inflation entered the picture. So the theory is the theory that the universe as we know it began some 13 to 15 billion years ago, and now that number is claimed to be known to quite a bit of precision, 13.7 billion plus or minus 0.2. The initial state of the universe at this early time was a hot, dense, uniform soup of particles that filled space uniformly and was already expanding very, very rapidly. Now, I should maybe emphasize here that there is a cartoon image of the Big Bang, which I think is quite popular, but which is totally wrong, namely the idea that the universe started with all of the matter in a small egg that exploded out into empty space. That is not the scientific version of the Big Bang theory. As far as I can tell, it's just as plausible as the theory that we do subscribe to, but it doesn't do well with observations. The point is simply that if you had an egg that exploded, unless you were sitting right at the center of where the egg began, what you'd see is an egg over there and emptiness over there, and the sky would look very asymmetric. You'd expect things to look much hotter and denser if you look toward the egg than if you looked in the opposite direction. While in fact, when we look around the sky, what we see is the universe looks essentially the same in all directions. We can't see any region of the sky that looks different from any other region if you look out far enough to see beyond the local objects. So it's because of this uniformity that we observe, we really can't do with the theory of the egg. The theory is that matter filled space uniformly from the very beginning, for whatever reason. Inflation will help to explain that, and was already expanding. So this conventional form of the Big Bang theory describes how the early universe expanded and cooled. It describes how the light chemical elements formed. Maybe I should explain here that the model starts out so hot that even the nuclei of atoms would not have been stable at those enormous temperatures. So the nuclei have to be made as the universe cools. This issue was first addressed way back in the 1940s by George Gamow and his collaborators. And they actually became very frustrated because they could not figure out how any elements heavier than lithium could have been produced in the Big Bang. And there obviously are elements heavier than lithium. We now have a different way of looking at it. We believe that elements heavier than lithium were indeed not produced in the Big Bang. Gamow and his friends were right. The heavier elements were all produced in the interior of stars, and they're strewn out into space when stars undergo explosions, ready then to collect into later generation stars. And our solar system would be one of those later generation stars made out of elements cooked in a previous star that exploded long ago. But the latest chemical elements we still think were produced in the Big Bang. And we could actually use this theory in a quantitative way to calculate the expected abundances of the lightest, approximately five nuclei. And it works very well. And it has always been regarded as one of the successes of the classical Big Bang theory. Finally on my list, the conventional Big Bang theory describes how the matter congealed, ultimately, to form stars, galaxies, clusters of galaxies, and so on. Now, those issues are certainly still an ongoing project. I don't want to make it sound like the work on that is finished. But we do think that all of this fits into the conventional Big Bang theory very consistently. So those are the good points of the conventional Big Bang theory. But of course, I want to talk about inflation, so you might guess where I want to go to next is the items that the classical Big Bang theory does not explain. And basically, what it doesn't explain is a little surprising given its name. It's referred to universally as the Big Bang Theory, but in fact, what the theory says nothing about is the Big Bang itself. I always like to say that the theory says nothing about what banged, why it banged, or what happened before it banged. Nothing. Rather, the theory is truly really a theory of the aftermath of the bang. The theory starts with all of the matter present, all of the matter uniformly distributed, all of the matter moving rapidly outward. That's the starting point for the theory. Another important item that the theory gives no explanation for is where all the matter came from. The conventional form of the Big Bang theory assumes that all matter existed from the very beginning. For every single particle in the universe today, there must have been at least some precursor particle that existed from the very beginning of the time that the theory describes the universe. Now, it may sound surprising that I'm even talking about creating the matter in the universe, but in fact, inflation actually does that, as we'll see in a few minutes. Okay, so this is the background. Now, what I'd like to do is to describe how inflation works and how it can answer some of these questions that are just not addressed by the conventional Big Bang theory. Inflation is a modification of the conventional Big Bang theory, providing a very brief prequel, using the word that comes out of Hollywood, but which is very appropriate here. Inflation gives a short prehistory to the description of the Big Bang. And in effect, inflation can explain the bang of the Big Bang in the sense that inflation provides a description of the force that propelled the universe into this gigantic period of expansion of which we are still part. Now, it explains it in terms of what I like to regard as a miracle of physics. Now, I should be careful here about the word miracle. It's unusual to hear physicists talking about miracles. We're basically not supposed to. As you've probably been told, I think some of the American courts have stated it pretty clearly, that supernatural explanations may be interesting, in some cases important, but they're not science. So we don't want a supernatural explanation. So when I talk about a miracle, I'm not talking about going outside of the laws of physics. What I'm talking about is simply aspects of the laws of physics which are surprising to most of us. Surprising both because they didn't teach us this in high school or even in our freshman physics courses, and secondly, because they lead to consequences that really are rather dramatic in terms of the way the universe may have evolved. So I'm going to describe inflation as resting on two miracles of physics, the first of which is here now, the one that causes the propulsion, and that is gravitational repulsion. The fact that according to general relativity, gravity is not always attractive, as it was in Newtonian physics. But in general relativity, gravity can also act repulsively. And in fact, Einstein took advantage of that from the very beginning. You might recall that shortly after inventing general relativity, Einstein applied it to the universe and realized that if you just had normal gravity and a static universe, which is what he thought the universe was, the universe would just collapse under the force of that gravity. Einstein still believed the universe was static at this point, so he added an extra term to the equations called the cosmological constant to hold the universe up, to create a repulsive force, to oppose the normal kind of gravity. And this repulsive force fits in very naturally into the theory of general relativity. To Einstein, it was just an extra term that he added to the equations. From a modern point of view, this extra term is interpreted, and this will be important to what I'll be talking about later, this extra term is interpreted as attributing an energy density to empty space. And simple energy density to empty space causes a repulsive gravitational force, according to general relativity. And there are other things that can do it as well. So general relativity offers this possibility of repulsive gravity, and inflation takes advantage of it to describe the propellant of the Big Bang itself. So according to general relativity, the key point is that pressures, as well as energy densities, can create gravitational fields. And actually, pressures can have either sign. So a negative pressure, in particular, creates a repulsive gravitational field. And that basically is the secret behind how inflation works. inflation is a natural consequence of things that are believed to happen in modern particle theories. So negative pressure implies repulsive gravity, as I've already said. And the key point is that particle theories suggest that there should be states of matter that produce negative pressures. In particular, if one has a scalar field, I might mention that scalar fields have not yet been seen, I have to admit. But nonetheless, all particle theorists, or almost all, are convinced that they exist. And in particular, the particle called the Higgs particle, which is being sought after at the Large Hadron Collider, is a particle that represents a scalar field. It's related to a scalar field in exactly the same way as a photon is related to the electromagnetic field. So scalar fields do play a crucial role in our theories, even though we have not seen them. I'm going to be assuming that scalar fields exist. If the scalar field has a potential energy function that looks either like that or like that, it can drive inflation. One gets negative pressure and repulsive gravity. If the potential looks like this, the inflation takes place when the scalar field is sitting right on top of the hill, just before it starts to roll down. Alternatively, the scalar field could just be rolling down from the top of a hill in a more normal-shaped potential energy function. And either way, one can produce inflation from particle physics, which is not known particle physics, but particle physics which is very similar and expected in the context of particle physics that we do know. Okay, so the way it works is inflation proposes that a patch of this negative pressure material existed in the early universe. It doesn't have to fill the universe. One just needs a patch of it. And how big the patch is depends on the energy scale at which inflation starts. That's actually not known. Inflation was invented in the context of these grand unified theories. But since then, we've realized that inflation could happen at energy scales somewhat significantly below the grand unified theory energy scale, although still high by conventional particle physics standards. For purposes of examples, I'm going to use the numbers from grand unified theories, which are still perhaps the most plausible, although we don't know. So if inflation happened at this grand unified theory scale, which is an energy scale of about 10 to the 16 billion electron volts, the patch could be as small as 10 to the minus 28 centimeters, which, of course, is an absolutely ridiculously small size. Since the patch is going to be enlarged fantastically by the inflation, the initial density of these patches could be incredibly low, and the theory would still work. The point is that once inflation happens, this tiny patch will be inflated by an enormous factor. So the inflationary patches can easily take over the universe, even if they start out being unbelievably rare. So the idea is that once the patch forms, the gravitational repulsion created by this negative pressure becomes the driving force of the Big Bang in each patch. The patch is driven into exponential expansion, and the time constant of that exponential expansion is ridiculously small, 10 to the minus 38 seconds. So in the first 10 to the minus 38 seconds, the patch expands by a factor of little e, 2.7. Next 10 to the minus 38 seconds expands again by a factor of e, again, and so on. So very rapidly, it becomes large, even though it started out at this ridiculously small size. The exponential expansion to make the theory work has to lead to an expansion of at least a factor of about 10 to the 28. That only requires about 65 time constants of the exponential expansion to do that. Exponentials are wonderful that way. You expand for some number of e folds, and the overall expansion factor gets to be a fantastically large number. Eventually, inflation ends. Inflation ends because the state with the negative pressure is really metastable. The scalar field, if it's perched on top of the hill, will roll off by quantum fluctuations. If it's already rolling down the hill, it will roll to the bottom. So eventually, the inflation will stop, and the energy from the false vacuum, the energy from the scalar field, in other words, produces a hot soup of ordinary particles, which quickly reaches thermal equilibrium and gives us exactly that hot soup of particles that I told you earlier was the starting point of the conventional Big Bang theory. And then conventional Big Bang takes over. This is where the prequel ends, and what you usually think of as the main feature, conventional cosmology, begins. OK, now I have to say something about what's going on with the energy during this time period. we're talking about a patch of material that expands linearly by a factor of 10 to the 28 or more. If we're any kind of ordinary material, the density of that material would thin out fantastically, and it would really just be empty vacuum that you have in the region. But this peculiar scalar field negative pressure material does not behave that way. Rather, as the patch expands, more and more mass energy appears in this region. So in fact, the density of energy remains constant, or approximately constant, during this fantastic period of expansion. Nonetheless, I claim that that's consistent with conservation of energy, which makes it sound like we need another miracle here. And indeed, my second miracle is coming up. The reason why all of that is consistent is that the energy of a gravitational field turns out to be negative. And that means that as the universe is undergoing this tremendous exponential expansion and more energy is appearing in the form initially of the scalar field, later becoming the energy of all the matter that we see, that positive energy is being canceled completely by a negative contribution to the energy in the gravitational field, which is filling this larger and larger regions of space. So the total energy of the system remains constant during this expansion and is no doubt approximately equal to zero and could very well be exactly equal to zero with the negative energy of the gravitational field just completely canceling the positive energy of all the matter in the universe. So we could very well be living, and if this theory is right, we are living, in a universe where the total energy is essentially zero or exactly zero. So the positive energy of the false vacuum, that's the state with the scalar field, was compensated by the negative energy of gravity, so the total energy of the universe may very well be zero. Okay, so far, we're now ready to change gears a bit. What I've just done is I've tried to explain to you the physics behind inflation and the story of how it could have happened. The next chapter of my talk here is to discuss the evidence for inflation. Inflation may be a consistent story, as I've just tried to describe, but is there any evidence that our universe actually followed this history? And I'll claim the answer is yes, and I want to focus on three particular pieces of evidence, three facts about our universe that make it look like our universe really did come about because of this process called inflation. So I want to talk about three items. The first is the large-scale uniformity of the universe. This large-scale uniformity is seen most clearly in the cosmic background radiation, the radiation that we view as the afterglow of the heat of the Big Bang. We also see the uniformity in the distribution of galaxies, but it's a little harder to be precisely quantitative about that. But in the cosmic background radiation, one can measure the temperature of the radiation to extraordinary precision now, and to an accuracy of about one part in 100,000, that radiation is uniform all across the sky, which is really an incredible level of uniformity if you think about it. One part in 100,000. Now, to understand what this means about the evolution of the universe, I need to tell you a little bit more about how this radiation evolved. The radiation is said to have been released at 400,000 years after the Big Bang. Now, what that word released means is that prior to 400,000 years, the universe was hot enough so that the gas that filled the universe was ionized. It was a plasma. Now, in a plasma, photons don't travel very far. The free electrons in a plasma have a very large cross-section for scattering the photons. So in a plasma, each photon individually travels at the speed of light between collisions, but each photon is constantly undergoing collisions and changing its direction. So the net effect during this first 400,000 years is that the photons really went nowhere, even though they were always instantaneously traveling at the speed of light. You could think of the photons as being frozen with the matter of the universe. Then, however, at about 400,000 years, the universe thinned out. The temperature dropped to the point where it became a neutral gas instead of a plasma, and it suddenly became very transparent to these photons. So when we look at the cosmic background radiation photons today, we are essentially seeing photons that have been traveling on almost straight lines for the last 400,000 years. That means that what we are seeing is very literally an image of what the universe looked like about 400,000 years after the Big Bang. Just as when you look at my face, using photons that are traveling on straight lines from my face to your eyes, you see an image of what my face looks like. Same thing for looking at the universe. So the implication then is that the universe itself was uniform to about one part in 100,000 by 400,000 years after the Big Bang. So is this surprising or is it not surprising? What does one expect? Well, we do, of course, all know that there's something that's usually referred to in physics as the zeroth law of thermodynamics, the law that somehow got left out and invented later and had to be put at the beginning. And this zeroth law of thermodynamics says that things come to thermal equilibrium. If you take a hot pizza out of the oven, it will cool to room temperature. That's the zeroth law of thermodynamics. So if it applied to the whole universe, that could explain how the universe got to have a uniform temperature throughout. But the key thing is how much time it takes. You can try to estimate how long it would take for the universe to smooth itself out if it did not start out completely smooth. And what you find is that even if you only take into account the limitation of the speed of light, you're already in trouble. If the universe did not start out uniform, for it to become uniform by 400,000 years after the Big Bang, it would have to be able to transport energy and information at a speed of about 100 times the speed of light. And of course, as you know, we don't know of anything in physics that can transport anything faster than the speed of light. So that means that within the context of the conventional Big Bang theory, there's no way that the universe could have been smoothed out by 400,000 years after the Big Bang. Now, you could, of course, assume the universe just started out completely smooth. That would work. But it's just a blind assumption. There's no physics in that. But if you want to create this uniformity by a physical mechanism after the universe has begun, then there's just no way you can do it within the context of the conventional Big Bang theory. Inflation changes all that in a very simple way. Inflation puts into the history of the evolution of the universe this period of enormous exponential expansion. That means that before the exponential expansion, the region that's going to become the observed universe was much smaller than it would have been in conventional cosmology. Because it was so small, there was plenty of time for it to become completely uniform before inflation started by essentially the same kinds of mechanisms that causes a pizza to cool to room temperature when you take it out of the oven. And then once this uniformity is established on this very tiny scale, inflation can take over and magnify that tiny speck to become large enough to include everything that we see. So inflation provides a very simple and natural explanation for how the universe got to be so uniform. So that's item one on my list, the uniformity of the universe. I promise you there'll be two more, so we'll go on to number two. Number two is what's called the flatness problem. Why was the early universe so flat? So first I want to clarify what I mean by flat. I have discovered that, I have discovered that sometimes people in the audience confuse flat with two-dimensional, because flat sometimes means two-dimensional. That's not what I mean here. The universe was never two-dimensional, as far as I know. Flat is also used to mean non-Euclidean, and that's the sense here. General relativity allows for the universe to either be curved or flat. In general, it's curved in general relativity. But the observed universe is nonetheless very close to flat. And the question is, why? First, to explain a little bit more what one means by flat versus curved, it's very hard to visualize a curved three-dimensional space. As far as I know, nobody can do it. I can't. But curved spaces are closely analogous. Curved three-dimensional spaces are closely analogous to curved two-dimensional spaces, which are easy to visualize. So I've shown here three different two-dimensional spaces, the surface of a sphere, a saddle shape, and a plane. The first two are curved. The closed geometry is called positive curvature. The saddle shape is called open geometry or negative curvature. And the surfaces are non-Euclidean. And the three-dimensional geometries that correspond to these are non-Euclidean in the same way. You can see the non-Euclidean nature. You should be able to see the non-Euclidean nature on these pictures. What is intended to be illustrated here is the fact that if you draw a triangle on the surface of a sphere, the corners get to bulge out a little bit. And if you added up the sum of those three angles, you would always get a number that's a little larger than 180 degrees. And that's the same true for a closed geometry in three dimensions. Conversely, the saddle shape tends to pinch the corners of the triangle. So the sum of the angles is always a little less than 180 degrees. And you get 180 degrees, as expected from Euclidean geometry, only for the plane, only for the flat geometry. And that carries over into these non-Euclidean three-dimensional spaces. And general relativity certainly allows the universe to have any of these three geometries, but it's very close to the flat one. Now, in general relativity, this geometry is linked to the mass density. And there's a certain value for the mass density called the critical density, which is the value that makes the universe precisely flat. This critical density is not a universal constant. It depends on the expansion rate. So in fact, it changes with time as the universe evolves. But for any given expansion rate, there is a mass density called the critical density. And cosmologists define this quantity capital omega, which is defined to be the actual mass density of the universe divided by this critical mass density. So if omega is 1, the universe is flat. If omega is bigger than 1, the universe is closed. And if omega is less than 1, the universe is open. And cosmologists always discuss the flatness of the universe in terms of this quantity omega, as I'm about to continue to do. Now, the key idea that makes understanding the flatness of the universe a problem is that omega being equal to 1 is an unstable equilibrium point. By unstable equilibrium point, what I mean is that it's like a pencil balancing on its edge, just like in these wonderful three-dimensional drawings that I figured out how to do with shadows and everything. Took time. the idea is that if a pencil is just leaning a little bit over from being straight up, it will rapidly fall in that direction. Even though if it was precisely straight up and you were following classical physics, it could in principle stay there forever. But it's very, very hard to balance it that closely. Omega being equal to 1 is just like that. So if in the early universe omega was just slightly below 1, it would rapidly fall to 0. And if it fell to 0 too quickly, there wouldn't be time for any galaxies to form. The mass density would just thin out, and you just have a thin gas filling the universe. Conversely, if omega was slightly greater than 1 in the early universe, it would rapidly rise to infinity, at which time the universe would then recollapse. And again, there would not be time for galaxies to form. So galaxies would not form. Galaxies will only form if omega in the early universe is incredibly close to 1. To be a little bit more quantitative about this, to be as close to the critical density as we measure today, if you extrapolate backward to 1 second after the Big Bang, omega must have been equal to 1 to 15 decimal places. Now, you might wonder why I picked 1 second. Actually, I didn't pick 1 second. This was originally stated by someone named Bob Dickey, who I learned this problem from. And he picked 1 second, but it's a natural time. The reason why 1 second is relevant is that 1 second actually is the beginning of those processes of nucleosynthesis, which produce the light chemical elements that I talked about in the introduction. So we really do think, because those calculations work, that we have direct evidence that our conventional picture of cosmology works all the way back to 1 second. So that's the picture that's being used to do this extrapolation. And it says that to make the theory work, you need to start out with omega being equal to 1 to 15 decimal places using conventional cosmology. I like to say that this means that the value of the mass density of the universe at 1 second after it began is perhaps the most precisely known number in physics. We really do know it to 15 decimal places. This is what it must have been, or else the universe would not look at all like what it looks like now. So how does that work? In conventional cosmology, one just has to assume that omega started out so ridiculously close to 1 for reasons totally unknown. There's no explanation in conventional cosmology as to why omega should have started out so close to 1. But inflation, things work differently. The point is that because gravity becomes repulsive during the period of inflation, the evolution of omega also changes. In particular, it means that omega, instead of being driven away from 1, omega is driven towards 1. And in fact, it's driven towards 1 extremely rapidly. So the initial value of omega could have been 2 or 5 or 10 to the minus 5 or 10 to the plus 5. The further it starts from 1, you need a little bit of extra inflation to drive it to 1, but that's all. It's no problem. So whatever the initial value of omega was, inflation would take care of driving it to 1, which is just like what we observe. Now, this mechanism which drives omega to 1 drives it very, very rapidly, which means that unless you stop inflation at just the right point, it will drive it closer to 1 than we know it to be, giving us a prediction that generically, at least, inflationary models should lead to a value of omega which is essentially exactly equal to 1. Now, when inflation was first invented, that was a problem until 10 years ago. The astronomers all kept telling me that the observed value of omega looks more like 0.2 or 0.3 and not 1. This, for example, made things pretty uncomfortable when I had dinner with astronomers because they'd keep telling me what was wrong with inflation. It predicted the wrong value of omega. And I grimaced and told them that I thought they were probably wrong, although I didn't know why. Anyway, all that has changed now, which is what makes things a lot of fun. The current best observational value of omega, based on data from the WMAP satellite combined with the 2-degree field galaxy survey and the Sloan Digital Sky Survey and the Supernova 1A observations, people put all that together. And this is the number they come up with for omega. The smallest error bar is known today. Now, this may be an exaggeration for how small the error bars is. It's a little bit dicey to combine different observations of that type. But I think everybody agrees that within at least about 1%, omega is known observationally to be equal to 1. The key thing that changed everything, I had actually thought the astronomers were just all wrong, but that turned out not to be entirely true. The key thing that changed things was a new discovery, a new kind of contribution to omega. Namely, in 1998, it was discovered that the expansion of the universe, is not slowing down as people had expected, but in fact is accelerating for about the last 5 billion years or so. And to make the universe accelerate requires stuff. It's believed to be done by negative pressure, exactly what I talked about earlier in the context of general relativity. We still don't know for sure what this stuff is. We call it dark energy, whatever it is. But even though we don't know for sure what it is, we can calculate how much of it there has to be to cause that much acceleration. And when that gets added to the rest of the matter, that's when you come up with these wonderful numbers for omega, like 1.005, which, of course, makes me very happy. So that ends item 2, I think, on my list. Going on to item 3. Item 3 is also very exciting. The small-scale non-uniformity of the universe. Now, I told you that on the largest scales, the universe looks unbelievably uniform. And really, on all scales, it's uniform to about 1 part in 100,000. That is, on all scales in the early universe. Clumping has made it much less uniform today. But we actually do see fluctuations at the level of 1 part in 100,000. That's not a limit. That's where we start to see fluctuations. And the observers have really developed incredible techniques for measuring these minute variations in the cosmic background radiation, both from ground-based observations, often done at isolated places like the South Pole, and also from satellite observations. It turns out that inflation makes a prediction for what they should look like, and those predictions work very well. I might start by saying that in conventional cosmology, there was never any explanation for where these non-uniformities may have come from. In conventional cosmology, before inflation was invented, those fluctuations were just put in by hand. But inflation turns out, it took us a while to figure this out, but inflation gives a natural source for these variations. It has to do with quantum physics. I guess I have words on that on my screen. Inflation attributes these ripples in the cosmic background radiation to quantum fluctuations. The idea is simply that the real world is quantum mechanical, and quantum theory, as you know, is not a deterministic theory, but rather a probabilistic theory. And that means that when the classical analysis following from inflation predicts that inflation should just smooth everything out, which is what it does predict classically, when one puts in the quantum mechanical corrections, this uniform density that would have been predicted at the classical level gets replaced by a density which is almost uniform, but some places, due to quantum uncertainties, the mass density is a little higher than the average, and in other places, due to quantum uncertainties, the actual mass density is a little lower than average, and that's exactly what the early universe looked like. And one can even get pretty quantitative about this. I should confess that we cannot, at the present time, use inflation to predict the magnitude of these fluctuations. That, in principle, could be predicted by inflation, but we require knowing much more about the scalar field that drives the inflation than we, in fact, do know. We haven't yet seen the scalar field that drives inflation, so we don't know what its potential energy function might look like. But nonetheless, even without being able to predict that, almost all models of inflation predict the form for the spectrum of fluctuations, which works very well. And by spectrum of fluctuations, I mean how the intensity varies with wavelength, exactly what we mean by spectrum when we talk about sound waves, for example. So let me show you some of that data. The best data comes from WMAP, although I'm actually going to be showing you other data as well. WMAP is a satellite experiment called the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe. That's Dave Wilkinson there. He was one of the pioneers of cosmic background radiation research from the very beginning. And he was one of the pioneers of launching this particular satellite. He died shortly after the satellite was launched, unfortunately, and the satellite was renamed in his honor. This is a picture of the satellite, which you might recognize from my first transparency. This is a picture of its orbit, which I won't talk about. In any case, cutting to the chase, this is the wonderful result. This is a graph of the spectrum of the fluctuations. The spectrum is measured in angular degrees. Angular because what you're seeing is an image on the sky, so your wavelength is measured in degrees, not in meters. So it's the intensity of the radiation, delta T, as a function of the intensity of the fluctuation, delta T, measured in microkelvin, as a function of the angular wavelength. Short wavelengths are to the right in this diagram, long wavelengths are to the left. The black marks are the actual data. There's a lot of points right along here on the central peak, which you can hardly see because the red line, which is the theoretical curve, overlaps them perfectly. As you can see, there's a fantastically good fit between the predicted curve, which is fit with about 5 parameters, but even so, it's still an amazingly good fit, versus the actual data. So I like to say eureka when I see this data. Just for comparison, I'd like to show you what some other theories would have predicted. And as you see, the other theories don't do nearly as well. Might just point out that the calculation for cosmic strings, which is a very difficult calculation, was first done, and this data comes from the paper by Uli Penn and some collaborators. And Uli Penn is now at CETA on your faculty here. I might, just to be completely honest, I should mention that there is one theory called the ekparotic cyclic model, which, according to its authors at least, gives exactly the same curve as the inflation. So inflation is not necessarily the unique theory which gives that. Although other people who have calculated with the same model, it remains controversial whether that's the right answer for the ekparotic model or not. OK, I just want to show you some more recent data. This is not plotted on the same scale, but this is the WMAP 5-year data plotted against the theoretical curve. This is the WMAP 3-year data again, but supplemented by experiments which go out to smaller angular scales. It's really done in terms of spherical harmonics, and these are the L's of the spherical harmonics. And here you can see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, maybe 7 peaks, and it all agrees quite well with the theoretical predictions. Okay, so that ends my discussion of the evidence for inflation. So now I'm ready to go on to the next, and I think essentially final chapter of my talk, the dark energy and how that enters into the whole picture and how this A word comes in as a possible explanation for why the dark energy is what it is. So let me explain what goes under that. The key thing starts in 1998, which I mentioned that date earlier, but what happened in 1998 actually is that astronomers discovered that the universe has been accelerating for about the last 5 billion years. And this was based on observations of a particular kind of supernova type 1A, which the astronomers used as what they call standard candles, meaning objects whose brightness they know intrinsically. And the good thing about a standard candle is that to some degree of accuracy, just by measuring its brightness, you can tell how far away it is. If you can also measure its redshift to determine how fast it was moving, you can establish from that the expansion history of the universe, how fast was the universe expanding at different times. And that's what led to this conclusion that the universe has been accelerating for about the last 5 billion years. Initially, those observations were somewhat controversial. This was a very surprising result. But gradually, other evidence came in, more experiments of the same type and very different types. And now I think really the whole astronomical community is very solidly convinced that this effect is real. The universe is accelerating. So the implication really is that inflation is happening today. It's caused by a negative pressure, as far as we know, as long as general relativity is correct. People have explored alternatives to general relativity, but certainly nothing has been established along those lines. And the conservative point of view is still that general relativity is correct. So I will follow that point of view. So if that's the case, then there has to be some negative pressure material which is filling space today. And that material is called the dark energy, for lack of a better word. Now you might ask, what is the dark energy? There is a very simple and concise answer to that question. Who knows? But there is a simplest explanation, although there are many others. The simplest explanation is that the dark energy is just vacuum energy, the energy of empty space. And that really is synonymous, means exactly the same thing as what Einstein called the cosmological constant. So we call it both. We go back and forth between those words. I will usually discuss it in terms of vacuum energy. Now, I might just mention that if the other explanations are right, things are still about as mysterious as I'll make them sound under this explanation. The other explanation, I think, are less plausible, not more plausible. And I'll try to explain to you that this explanation is highly implausible. So we don't have a plausible explanation. It's the bottom line of this. But we'll continue here. What is the nightmare of dark energy? Why is this not a good explanation? It fits the data perfectly, by the way. It's not that there's any glitches in our understanding of how to produce a theory that would account for this data. But the problem is that to account for this data, we have to assign an energy density to empty space. And we would like to have some explanation for the magnitude of that energy density that we're assigning. And that's where theory fails badly. We have no idea why the energy density is what it is. The basic idea that empty space can have mass, can have energy density, is not a problem for particle physicists. In the quantum world, empty space is a very complicated state. Electron-positron pairs are constantly popping out of the vacuum and disappearing. There are fields like the Higgs field that you may have heard about that are believed to have non-zero values in empty space. There's certainly plenty of reasons why the energy density of empty space should be non-zero. But the problem is to understand why it is what's observed. That's a real problem. In quantum field theory, we could try to calculate the energy density of all of these quantum fluctuations. And the answer we get is infinite. It just diverges. Now, it's worth understanding how the divergence comes about. It comes about because you think of the waves, the fluctuations that are creating this energy density, in terms of a Fourier sum, a sum of different wavelengths. And the idea, let's just look at the energy in some fictitious box that I'm going to draw with my hands. If we want to talk about the energy of the quantum fluctuations in this box caused by, say, just the electromagnetic field, we would first talk about the mode of the electromagnetic field that looks like this. And then that would contribute a certain quantum fluctuation, a certain energy. Then we talk about the mode that does this, and then the mode that goes up and down 3 times, and the mode that goes up and down 4 times. And each of those will contribute an energy. And the problem is it doesn't stop. There's no shortest wavelength. We have any number of wiggles, and each number of wiggles will contribute further to this energy density of the vacuum. And that's where the infinity comes from these incredibly short wavelength fluctuations that you get to when you go up and down and up and down a few zillion times. So particle physicists are happy to believe that those infinities are not part of the true physics, because we don't think that the quantum field theories that we use are necessarily valid down to unbelievably short distances, which is where the infinity is coming from. So it's sensible to cut it off at some point, to say, I believe the physics down to this wavelength, but beyond that, I just don't know anymore, so I won't try to calculate it. It's debatable where to do that cutoff, but it turns out not to matter that much. If you cut off at any sensible particle physics scale, you're in trouble. Most of us think that the natural cutoff is what's called the Planck scale, which is the energy or wavelength at which we think quantum gravity becomes important, because we know we don't understand quantum gravity very well. So we can cut off at that point. And then you could estimate what the vacuum energy would be. And the problem is that when you do that, you get a number that's still too large, and it's too large by 120 orders of magnitude. So it's not a near miss, it's a gigantic miss. It's an ouch. How could we possibly be so far off? And that's the problem. We just have no idea why the energy density that we're seeing for empty space can be anywhere near this small. People have tried to cook up different theories, and theories have been proposed. Certainly no theory has come close to being accepted, and I think it's fair to say that no theory that has come up with so far looks the least bit plausible. But then there is this A-word explanation. So let me explain how the A-word explanation, the anthropic principle, offers a possible explanation for this. First of all, we need to get to the idea of a multiverse. And this comes out of inflation. And I think this is pretty solid. The point is that the repulsive gravity material, this false vacuum that drives the inflation, is metastable. So it decays if you wait long enough. And that's how inflation is believed to end. The catch, though, is that if you look at any one location, the probability of remaining in an inflating state decays like most metastable materials. That is, it decays exponentially. Has essentially a half-life. So if you wait many half-lives, you think, well, it's almost certainly decayed. The catch, however, is that while you're waiting for this half-life to occur, meanwhile, the whole system is exponentially expanding. The universe in the meantime is expanding exponentially. And in any successful version of inflationary theory, the exponential expansion is, in fact, vastly faster than the exponential decay. So what that means is the somewhat counterintuitive fact that if you wait for one half-life of this decay, of this inflating material, indeed, at the end of the half-life, half of it will be decayed by definition. But the half that remains will be vastly larger than what you started with. So in fact, it's not going away. It's getting bigger and bigger with time. And this is what is known as eternal inflation that never stops. So the volume that is inflating increases with time, even though the inflating material is decaying. And the effect of that is that the inflation becomes eternal. Once it starts, it never stops. And what happens is the best way to visualize it is as an inflating region of space where pieces of that region of space become normal matter in regions locally. This inflating state decays and becomes normal matter. And each time it decays, it produces what we call a pocket universe. These pocket universes are, every one of them, big enough to easily encompass the observed universe. So we would be living in one of these pocket universes. But we call them pocket universes because they're only one of many. And the set of all pocket universes gets called the multiverse in this language. So we produce, in fact, an infinite number of these pocket universes. They just go on getting produced ad infinitum. And instead of one universe, inflation produces an infinite number, and that is what is called the multiverse. So how does this help us solve the cosmological constant problem? Well, hold on, we'll see. It plays in with another important idea, which comes from a different area of particle physics, string theory. For many years, string theorists have tried to figure out what the vacuum of string theory should look like. And they always failed. They couldn't figure out anything, any state that would be particularly much like a vacuum. And finally, they've settled, on the idea that the reason they had so much trouble is that string theory has no unique vacuum. Instead, it is now believed that string theory has a huge number, perhaps 10 to the 500 or even more, very long-lived metastable states, any one of which could serve as the substrate, as the underlying state, for one of these pocket universes. Any one of these can serve essentially as a vacuum about which a universe can be built. And that's what's known as the landscape of string theory. The word landscape appeared in my title, you may have noticed. And that's what it refers to. Now, if that idea gets combined with the idea of eternal inflation, then you can adopt the idea that as these pocket universes are formed, what you'd expect is that the fields inside of this region would constantly be undergoing fluctuations, and pockets of all types could be produced. So one expects that any one of the 10 to the 500 different metastable vacuums can be the vacuum inside one of these pocket universes. And pocket universe would be produced of every type. And one talks about inflation populating the landscape of string theory. Now, what would that mean about life inside one of these pocket universes? I think I'll make it. What would that mean about life inside one of these pocket universes? Well, the idea here is that the ultimate laws of physics are universal. It's string theory, and the claim is that there's one string theory. But inside of one of these pocket universes, the low-energy physics is really just the physics of perturbations about the vacuum that happens to exist inside that pocket. So it would be different from pocket to pocket. And in particular, since each pocket has a different vacuum, the vacuum energy density would be different inside of all of the pockets. And with 10 to the 500 of them, now you get a lot of tries, some of those will have vacuum energy densities as small as what we see and lower, even though a typical vacuum energy in one of these pockets, according to this point of view, would be this very high number, 10 to the 120 orders of magnitude larger than what we observe. OK, so then the question is, why, if that were the case, why would we be living in one of these very unusual vacua where the energy is 120 orders of magnitude smaller than a typical energy? There needs to be some explanation for that, or else you don't really have any explanation at all. If we're just incredibly unlucky or lucky, that's not an explanation. Physics doesn't depend on luck. So we need to have some explanation for why we might find ourselves in such a low energy density. And that's where the A word comes in. And the A word is now often known by a more sophisticated phrase, because it gets by better, the idea of environmental selection. And to explain how that works, I'd like to first start with an issue where I think we'll all agree environmental selection really does play a key role. So instead of talking about the energy density of the universe, let me change gears for a second, just as an example, and talk about the local energy density, the energy density right around us, say within a 100-mile sphere drawn around this auditorium. The energy density or mass density in that region is on the order of something like a gram per cubic centimeter. Now you might say, you might naively think that that must be typical of the universe, but it sure ain't. The universe is an unbelievably empty place where the average mass density is actually about 10 to the minus 30 grams per cubic centimeter. So the mass density in the region we inhabit is literally about 30 orders of magnitude higher than the typical mass density in our observed universe. Now, 30 orders of magnitude is not 120, but nonetheless, it's large enough so it should give you pause and ask yourself, do I understand why I happen to be living in such an unusual place in the universe? So you can ask yourself, why is this so? Why are we living in such an unusual place? Is it just chance? Is it luck? Is it divine providence? I think most of us would probably agree it's none of those. The answer is the selection effect. Most of us would, I think, accept the idea that this is a selection effect in the sense that life can evolve only in those rare regions of the universe where the density of matter is unusually high. So we don't expect to find living creatures in gas clouds in the universe and things like that where the density is fantastically lower. We expect that life would form on planets that would look something like Earth because that's the natural place for life to form. So the explanation for the energy density of space itself that's being proposed is similar. As early as 1987, Steve Weinberg pointed out that the cosmological constant might be explained in exactly the same way. He didn't use the mass density of the local environment as an analogy, but that was his idea. The idea is that maybe the cosmological constant is huge in most of these pocket universes. Nonetheless, we should remember that this cosmological constant does have a strong effect on those universes. It governs the expansion rate, or the acceleration rate anyway. So if the cosmological constant were negative and large, it would cause the universe to quickly collapse. If it was large and positive, the universe would fly apart in a very short length of time. So one would not expect galaxies to form. So it is very plausible, he argued, that life arises only if the cosmological constant is very near zero, thereby providing an explanation for what we observe. This was pursued in more detail in 1998 by Martel, Shapiro, and Weinberg, who made very serious quantitative calculations of under what circumstances would galaxies form successfully. And they concluded that within about a factor of 10 or so, the cosmological constant would have to be as small as what we observe for galaxies as we know them to form. Now, this is controversial, I should describe, to be honest. A number of physicists regard these anthropic ideas as ridiculous, and I think many would use exactly that word, maybe even words that are less polite. I would say that the anthropic principle should be considered as the explanation of last resort. And by that, I mean that you should not be too quick to accept it, because until we actually understand the landscape and how life forms and all things like that, we can't really use it as a predictive theory. Best we can do is give plausibility arguments for these anthropic explanations. We can't really calculate what their real consequences would be unless we understand everything that goes behind them. Therefore, the anthropic arguments become attractive only when the search for more deterministic explanations have failed. And so far, that is the case, though, for the cosmological constant. I might add that anthropic explanations have been discussed for a number of other quantities in physics, like the mass of the Higgs particle, the top quark mass, and the magnitude of the density perturbations in the universe. And all of those issues are up for grabs. We don't really know if these anthropic arguments should be accepted or not. The real question then is it time to accept the explanation of last resort, say for the cosmological constant problem? And I'm happy to admit that your guess is as good as mine. I don't know if there's any real way of knowing for sure. But I would claim that for the cosmological constant, because it seems so hard to explain it in any other way, it does seem like it's time to take this selection effect argument seriously. And it is being taken seriously by a number of cosmologists. When the idea was first introduced into physics, which may go back to the 60s, I'm not sure, the vast majority of physicists, including me, considered it ridiculous. But since the discovery of the cosmological constant, many people are now taking it quite seriously. And it is talked about at almost every cosmology conference these days. It's hard to deny that as of now, the selection effect explanation really is by far the most plausible explanation that we know of. Now, this is disappointing. There's a couple more transparencies. This is certainly disappointing to many of us, because in the early days of string theory, there was a strong hope that if we understood the underlying theory of nature, which might be string theory, we'd be able to use it to make predictions for the parameters of the standard model of particle physics. As you probably know, there is a standard model of particle physics, which can really predict essentially everything that we can observe in particle physics experiments. But that theory has 20-some free parameters. And the theory has never been regarded as fundamental because it's so ad hoc, the way all of these different terms are put together. And it was always hoped that maybe something like string theory could actually predict the values for these parameters, so we would not have to just rely on measurement to determine them. But if the landscape picture is correct, it really could be that all these values are determined, at least in part, by just historical accidents. They may not be determined by string theory. And that means that we would have much less predictive power from theoretical physics than many of us had hoped. Now, meanwhile, the advocates of this point of view have pointed out that this is not the first time this has happened, and I think they're right about that. You have to go back pretty far, however, but to find a really good example, you can go back to the time of Kepler. To Kepler, the solar system was the universe. That's all people really knew about. There was this background of stars, but that was just painted on some sphere. So Kepler spent, as you know, a large amount of effort into trying to understand the radii of the orbits of the planets, which he was convinced, since this was the universe, must be related to some very fundamental facts about nature. And he built these models of embedded regular solids inside of regular solids that we all remember seeing pictures of in our high school astronomy books. But he realized that it did not quite work. He was never able to get that to work, and he was disappointed. But from a modern point of view, all that is ridiculous. We do think of the orbits of the planets as just being determined by historical accidents as our particular solar system formed. We now think of our particular solar system as one of many, many in the observable universe. And presumably, they all have planets with different radii. In fact, we've observed that now. So the radii of planets are just no longer thought of as being fundamental. They're historical accidents. So if this landscape point of view is correct, perhaps things like the charge of an electron and the mass of the W meson may also be historical accidents and not determined by any fundamental principles of nature. So I'm ready to summarize now. Point one, which is the main point I'd like you to take home, the inflationary paradigm is in great shape. Inflation can explain why the universe is so smooth and homogeneous when averaged over large regions, why we see it being so smooth in the cosmic background radiation. It could explain why the mass density of the universe is so close to this critical value. And it can also explain the patterns that we see in the ripples in the cosmic background radiation. An interesting feature of inflationary models is that almost all of them lead to eternal inflation in the future and produce not just one universe, but a whole multiverse of pocket universes. Meanwhile, this blends into ideas coming out of string theory. String theorists mostly agree string theory has no unique vacuum, but instead a landscape of perhaps 10 to the 500 or more very long-lived metastable states, any one of which could be our vacuum or the vacuum in one of these pocket universes. And finally, eternal inflation can populate this string theory landscape. And the combination of the idea of inflation with the idea of the landscape provides a very natural setting for the A word, for these anthropic arguments. They no longer sound religious, but are now a natural consequence of some basic physics that that might be correct. And they could explain why we see a small cosmological constant, for example, because it's possible that conscious beings only form in those parts of the multiverse. How'd that happen? Where the cosmological constant is small. So it could be that all conscious beings observe a very small cosmological constant, even though in most places in the multiverse, the cosmological constant is 120 orders of magnitude larger. So the bottom line is that we've never had a model of the universe that works so well. We understand the homogeneity, the mass density, and even the spectrum of these density fluctuations. But at the same time, the model is completely mysterious. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. That was a grand